Thanks, everybody. As Philip said, I'm Stephanie Geller. I'm a policy analyst at Rhode Island Kids Count, where we do statewide policy and advocacy work, really focused on data-driven decision-making. And I work on education and economic well-being policy, but have a former sort of public health hat. So I'm very interested in talking a lot about how we can improve education specifically and how that impacts health. I'm also the project director for our grant, which is called Healthy Futures Education from Cradle to College. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about our policy objectives and how we got there, starting with early childhood and working through college. Talking a little bit about the goals of our project, the different coalitions we work with, some of the policy objectives we had, and the strategies we used to achieve those objectives. All right, so first, I think this is all pretty well laid out from Philip's original presentation, but I just wanted to kind of walk a little bit through what we all know, which is the connections between education and health. We all know that the education level that a person ultimately achieves really affects that individual's health behaviors, access to health, and health outcomes. And since we're a child-focused organization, we also think a lot about how parents' education levels affect a child's ultimate well-being in the areas of health, educational achievement, and their ability to achieve future earnings and success as adults. And we were really pleased when this grant opportunity came around and this opportunity to really highlight the connections between education and health and to raise the visibility between these connections and also the opportunity to bring new champions to our work in terms of moving education policy by reaching out to the folks in the health policy and at the health department, physicians and others, to bring them to the table and get them to work on improving educational outcomes and also raising awareness through the media and other ways of the connections between health and education. And so I'm going to be talking a little bit about how we did that, how we brought the coalitions together and some of our efforts. I just wanted to also show the same slide that Philip did, which really just to sort of provide a little outline of the kinds of things I'm going to talk about in terms of how we chose the policy objectives we worked on and then how we move forward in trying to achieve those objectives. So again, I'm going to talk a little bit about assessing the community's needs and resources, so what we saw as the problem, focusing on what's important, so trying to identify why achieving these policy objectives in the area of education was important to a child's ultimate well-being, including their health, how we chose which policies and programs would be most effective at meeting those goals. Acting on what's important, so I'll be talking about things like return on investment and how we evaluated the effectiveness of our efforts. This is a graphic that comes from a group called Strive that's out of Cincinnati, and they do a lot of really great work in the area of education, bringing together multi-sectoral coalitions to work towards improving educational outcomes from cradle to college and career. And one of the coalitions I work with, the Providence Children and Youth Cabinet, is a member of Strive, and I think this is also a helpful framework in terms of looking at the different ways we can affect the educational trajectory of a child. These are the goals that our project framed at the beginning, and I'm going to just talk a little bit about each of these goals as we move on, but just so you have them all in front of you, we had a pretty ambitious agenda looking from cradle to college, not just focusing on early childhood, not just focusing on college, but looking at the whole pathway. And the key policy areas we chose to focus on were ensuring that state funding for our state public pre-K program was allocated according to our education funding formula. It was still a new formula, and so there were still risks that the money that was promised would not come and allow us to incrementally increase that program. To increase access to full-day kindergarten in districts across the state. Also, both our state and the district, the Providence district, were working on establishing an early warning system to use things like attendance, behavior, course performance, to identify students at risk of dropping out and then to develop intervening strategies. We also focused on increasing the rigor of the high school curriculum by looking at the Common Core curriculum, which even those of you who don't really focus on education can't really miss hearing about in the media lately, all the focus on Common Core, and also to increase the availability of AP course offerings, especially in our urban low-income schools. And then finally, we worked on identifying and building systems for providing in-school and community-based support to help students with the college application process so more students would have the support they needed to enroll in college. I think like one of the groups that Philip highlighted earlier, we actually worked with three existing coalitions on a variety of different goals among those I just laid out. One of those coalitions is the Providence Children and Youth Cabinet, which was actually established under the former mayor, who's now in Congress, and then built on with the current mayor, Angel Taveras, who is a great champion for this work. He bills himself as the Head Start to Harvard mayor, the first Latino mayor of Providence, and really has gotten behind this work. So in this area, we have 175 individuals representing more than 70 organizations in health, early childhood, child care, K-12 education, youth-serving organizations, workforce development organizations, all working together to achieve goals that they've laid out as the Providence Children and Youth Cabinet. Everything from increasing kindergarten readiness all the way through increasing college completion. And the other two coalitions we worked with are the Rhode Island Early Learning Council. This council is working on everything from early childhood to kindergarten readiness through grade three or reading on grade level by the end of third grade work. And it's a coalition made up of stakeholders including child care workers, early childhood education specialists, individuals from the Department of Health, K-12 education, policymakers, et cetera. And it's co-chaired by the State Commissioner on Education and somebody from my organization, Rhode Island Kids Count. And the other coalition we're working with is the Rhode Island College Access and College Access and Success Work Group. And this is a group that pulls together folks who work in the K-12 education sector with those who are working in higher education and doing work on things like connecting the data system so we can really see how changes in the K-12 system impact improved outcomes in higher education. So just to give you an idea of the different groups we worked with to achieve some of these outcomes that we continue to work with. So I'm just going to talk a little bit in more detail about a few of these policy objectives, starting with the one around pre-K. So first, thinking back about the different strategies that we laid out in that sort of cycle you saw at the beginning of the presentation, we really clearly identified the problem and wanted others to get behind understanding the problem. We saw that problem as really twofold. One, that access to preschool is uneven. Those who have money can afford to pay for private preschool, and those who don't, and then their children have no or very little or low quality early childhood education experience when they enter the K-12 system. Just as a sort of a rule to think about, preschool generally costs a little under $10,000 a year, totally out of reach for many of our low-income families, those who really need the access to early childhood education before they enter kindergarten. We also knew that quality was really a problem. Those early childhood education programs that were out there were under-resourced, they had inadequate facilities, they had low-paid staff and high turnover. Many of the staff were poorly trained, had low education levels themselves, often nothing beyond a high school diploma. So we really wanted to continue to grow our pre-K program, which has been identified as a very high-quality program, meeting all of what they call the NEER benchmarks, which is a national group that looks at the quality of early childhood programs. Again, we wanted to focus on and thinking about focusing on what's important. Why is pre-K important? We thought it was important because we knew from the research the impact it can have on children in terms of their school readiness, in terms of their likelihood of continuing on without being retained in the later grades, less likely to require special education. So from a fiscal standpoint, putting in money early can save money down the road in special education costs. A lot of work out there saying that those who attend high-quality early childhood programs have higher graduation rates, are less likely to become pregnant as teens, and connected to the work we're all talking about here, have better physical and behavioral health outcomes going forward. And as adults, they're more likely to be employed, earn higher salaries, and less likely to be involved in the criminal justice system. And then talking more broadly, there's also an effect on our on society and the economy, again, with significant government savings in terms of more likely to be employed and to earn more, reduced crime, and increased tax revenues. So then thinking about what the effect of policies and programs are, we wanted to also talk a little bit about return on investment, and that luckily there was some really good research on return on investment for high-quality pre-K programs. And we had one of the good strategies we used was having a very high-profile national researcher come out and talk to people about the return on investment of pre-K, of high-quality pre-K. So we had a gentleman called named Steve Barnett from NEAR come out and speak to both these both sides of the General Assembly in separate sessions, and also speak to our major major statewide foundation, which really got everybody to really get on board and believe this was the way to go. And I saw legislators carrying around the PowerPoint from this presentation for more than a year after he gave it. So it was really a turning point in getting people to support this work. So sort of just really quickly going through, these are some of the milestones we've achieved along the way in terms of advocating for increased access to pre-K. So it's taken a while. We had a pre-K exploration committee, passed an Education Act requiring planning a pilot, and then we actually got it built into the funding formula. So built into the funding formula so that when we passed our education formula a few years ago, it allowed for incremental increases in public pre-K over a 10-year period. We also got a demonstration program going. And then just, I think, to be honest, that everything is not a smooth road and everything doesn't go forward the way you planned. We had a year where, even though it was in the plan, the General Assembly did not allocate the funds as was laid out in the funding formula. So we had to scramble around and find advocates to get on board and to sort of fill in that money. So we found local foundations who were willing to put money in so we could keep those pre-K seats, and also school departments who really wanted to keep pre-K in their district, and they put in some money too. So it's really it's moving forward now, and this is probably a good. You can see it's a small program. We started with no state pre-K seats in Rhode Island not too many years ago, and this coming year coming up, it's 234 seats. They're focused in our highest need districts with the highest child poverty rates, districts where we know that more than a third of children are living in poverty. So talking a little bit about the next of our policy goals, which was really increasing access to full-day kindergarten, and I should say that we really tried to pair those two things together, because sometimes those who were advocating for pre-K felt like the full-day K people were competing with them for the same resources, so we really tried to avoid that happening by pairing them together. So again, we talked about why is this important. We know that having full-day kindergarten, not surprisingly, it's kind of common sense, allows for more time for meaningful learning activities. If you're in school for 6 hours instead of 3 hours, you're getting more education. We also knew that those who had participated in full-day kindergarten had lower retention rates in terms of later grades. We know that you're more likely to be enrolled in kindergarten, and we know that they also have higher attendance rates. It feels more important to go to kindergarten for parents if they know that it's a longer day, so they tend to more likely enroll their children. And if they're late because they're at a dentist appointment or something, they maybe wouldn't bother continuing to even send them that day if they missed an hour to go to that dental appointment, whereas if it's a full day, they're more likely to make sure they get there every day. We also know that children from disadvantaged households benefit the most, and randomized trials have shown that it also improves test scores in the later grades. Talking a little bit about some of the milestones you've achieved here, again, I think this really illustrates how you have to sort of change your strategy as you have successes and setbacks. We really tried for a number of years to get legislation passed to require that districts have full-day kindergarten, and we just felt like we were beating our head against the wall. It just wasn't working. So we also built it into the. We also worked to build it into the funding formula so that districts get twice as much money for a full-day child as they get for a half-day child, so it's advantageous to have full-day kindergarten. In fact, one district that tried to save money by cutting back from full-day kindergarten to half-day kindergarten found that they actually lost money because of the money they lost in the funding formula. So even they intended to save money and they actually lost money. So it was a negative. The kids lost and the district lost monetarily. So what we ended up doing instead was really working to pass the Full-Day Kindergarten Accessibility Act, which provides grant funding to districts who need money, startup money, to do things like build out classrooms, buy materials, buy furniture, et cetera. So we were able to pass not this past session, but the session before that. But no money, but the bill was written so that it required appropriations. And that last year, no appropriations came. But this was sort of part of our strategy. We knew it would be easier to pass a bill without appropriations tied to it. So we got the bill passed last year. And this year, we were able to slide those appropriations in. So for this coming year, the first time districts will have money available to help them pay for startup funds. And here you can see how full-day kindergarten has been increasing in Rhode Island. The purple bar, purple line at the bottom is the whole state, and the black line at the top is the four core cities, which are our four communities with the highest child poverty rates. And you can see that dip where it went down. That was that district that made that really poor decision of cutting full-day kindergarten and losing money for their district. And I'm hearing they're going to be applying for those funds, and hopefully we'll get that back in that high-need district. So again, I just want to highlight the strategies we thought were really successful and that we need to continue to maintain is maintaining differential reimbursement for full-day kindergarten versus half-day kindergarten and doing district-level advocacy. So we frequently meet with the superintendents and talk to them about the benefits of full-day kindergarten. If they're going to grow it incrementally in their district, we suggest they focus on the schools with the highest poverty rate or the highest percentage of students who are free and reduced-price lunch. And those have the lowest third and fourth grade reading rate, so they put it where it's most needed. And our hope is that by the 2015-2016 school year, 100% of Rhode Island students will have access to full-day kindergarten. Then I'm going to sort of lump together these other three goals we had that are focused on high school and college, the early warning system, high school rigor, and college enrollment goals. So again, we wanted to focus on why this was important. A really seminal study came out of Georgetown University a few years ago showing that in by 2018, 63% of jobs in the country will require some post-secondary education, and 61% of jobs in Rhode Island, and this is a very powerful graphic for people who really, we're going to need this kind of educated workforce in order for people to get jobs. We also often talk about return on investment for individuals and their community by highlighting the differences in unemployment rates and incomes for those without high school diplomas, with high school diplomas, and with bachelor's degrees. And we put out some policy briefs and brought folks together to talk about some of these issues. This is one of the more powerful graphics from one of the policy sessions we had, where we really focused on the differences in college enrollment for low and high income students, in particular the much lower likelihood they have of enrolling in a four-year institution. And then this graph I've been seeing it all over the state since we presented it. It's from another source, but we presented it this past summer when I presented the College Access and Success issue brief we put out. And since then, it's been getting a lot of play at the General Assembly and elsewhere as people talk about where we lose our kids in the pipeline. So you can see this is a graphic for the U.S. as a whole, but we also broke down the data for Rhode Island. So 77% of students in Rhode Island get a high school diploma in 4 years. 54% of those students enroll in college, so that's now 42% of the original who started out of ninth grade, and then only 58% of those graduate from college. So that's 24%, or only one quarter of students who started out in the ninth grade actually getting a post-secondary degree. Again, here are highlighting some of the areas of work we did. We've been advocating for a while for a more rigorous requirements for a high school diploma. We've successfully gotten in-state tuition for undocumented students passed through the Board of Education, raised the compulsory attendance age from 16 to 18, so to encourage more students to stay in school longer to get their high school diploma, did a great report, which I think I uploaded for those of you who are accessing online materials from here, a great report where I did focus groups with youth in Providence about what support they need from schools and from the community to help them access a college, to enroll in college, to get financial aid, et cetera. And then we've been supporting both the statewide and the Providence work on developing early warning systems. And we're doing some more focused work in Providence, including something I'm really excited about, which is a service and data sharing agreement between the district and a whole variety of community organizations so that we all kind of call these kids our kids. And they're going to be allowed, the district will be allowed to share data on things like attendance and discipline and course performance and test scores and then identify kids that need support and community agencies that can step in and provide that support. So the key takeaways I wanted to leave you all with were really, focus on what's important, choose effective policies and programs, the importance of building and sustaining coalitions and working towards collective impact, selecting the indicators or the data that allow you to track how well you're meeting those outcomes, Don't forget to continually evaluate your progress. And I think these last two, I think, are the most important takeaways for me, which is celebrate incremental wins and early wins. So even if you don't get what you really wanted at the very beginning, recognize that those incremental wins are a great step along the way. And change your tactics when you need them to address barriers and build on successes. And I hope you saw those lessons in my presentation. And I hope you'll contact me if you have any interest in learning more about this work. Thanks so much.